Hello, I'm Fred Stella, president of the Interfaith Dialogue Association. Welcome to another edition of Common Threads. Well, kids, get ready. We have just an amazing story for you this week. I'm not going to set it up too much. I'm simply going to say that my friend Rabbi David Krishev gathered together a group of people, I would say it's close to a year now, and told us the beginning of this story. He only told us the beginning because that's all he had at the time. As the year progressed, he's educated us further until I believe this story has culminated in a conclusion of sorts. Actually, we'll have to find that out as well. Let me tell you a little bit about Rabbi David Krishev. He is the rabbi of the Grand Rapids Ahavas Israel Congregation, synagogue on the northeast side of Grand Rapids. He has been very involved in the interfaith movement over the years. He is the coordinator for the Grand Rapids Press column, Ethics and Religion Talk. And he also formed, along with the help of a couple of other people, an interfaith clergy council that meets monthly here in Grand Rapids. We welcome to Common Threads, Rabbi David Krishev.
Thank you, David. Thank you very much.
You know, this is a unique show. I don't believe I've ever done anything quite like this, where we're really just telling a story. Normally, we're talking about theology or ethics, reviewing a book, something like this. But what I would like to do is give you free rein to tell the story, to tell the account of what you just recently experienced over the past year. But before you do that, because I remember when a group of us were at the synagogue and you were telling us about this incident, you prefaced it by a true story of a cantor in Nebraska and what happened to him and the transformation that took place of another person. So I think to help people get the context of what happened to you, please take a few minutes and tell us what happened with the cantor in Nebraska.
Sure. Okay, Fred. I'm going to tell the story because the story happened sometime in the mid or late 80s. I heard about it shortly after it happened, and it laid a seed in my mind that I was just waiting to germinate somewhere. Okay. So before I came to Grand Rapids, I was a seminary student in New York, and I interviewed at a few different congregations and ultimately ended up in Grand Rapids. But one of the congregations was in Lincoln, Nebraska. This was in 1994, early in the year, in the winter. And when I got there and started talking to people about the community, they told me this fascinating story about the cantor in the Reform congregation down the block somewhere, whose name was Michael Wasser. So later on, Michael wrote a book based on this story. So if you are intrigued by the story, Google Michael Wasser, Rabbi Michael Wasser, and he's now a rabbi, and you can buy his book, and it'll give you more of the story than I have a chance to tell. But this is what happens. So Cantor Wasser had either just taken the position in this congregation, or he may have just moved into a new house in a new neighborhood in Lincoln. And he started getting these phone calls. And these were terrible phone calls. This was decades before the time that the police would act on phone calls like this, because they were real threatening phone calls. The Jew boy, you better leave town because I'm coming after you. Okay? Things like that, just terrible things. And he went to the police and he told the police, I'm getting these phone calls. Can you help me out? And the police said, we know who's making those calls. There's a local guy He's the former Grand Dragon of the KKK, and he's a member of the Nazi Party. And he lives here in Lincoln, and he will occasionally, you know, call people and leave them, you know, threatening messages. And that's all the police could or would tell him. So he kept getting these calls saying, you know, Wasser, you better move out of my neighborhood, right? Things like that. So he and his wife talked this over a bit, trying to figure out what are we going to do with this. And between them, they decided, you know, Michael, why don't you call this guy back and start leaving him messages? And maybe at some point he'll pick up the phone, right? So Michael started calling this man and leaving him messages like, you know, you've got a lot of hate in your heart. Yeah? Maybe you'll be a happier person if you try to love other people instead of hate them. And another time he called back. I should mention that when he called this number, it's like calling the inspirational KKK message of the day. So he'd call the number and he'd have to listen through this horrible message about neo-Nazis and, you know, anti-Black, anti-Jew, anti-Asian, anti-everybody else. Right? And then at the end of the message, this was a home answering machine, there'd be a beep, and he would then have the chance to leave his message. So it turns out that this man is in a wheelchair from diabetes. And Michael left a message one time saying something like, you know, if you were in Nazi Germany, you would have been one of the first people that Hitler killed. Yeah, he didn't like people in wheelchairs. So this went on for some period of time. And finally, in one of these phone calls, the phone picks up and Michael hears this voice saying, "Why are you bothering me? Right? Will you please stop calling me? What do you want from me?" So Michael and his wife had talked about this. Said, "Well, what do I do?" Michael said, "What do I do if he picks up?" The man's name was Larry Trapp. "So what do I do if Larry picks up the phone?" And his wife said, "Why don't you just ask him if he needs anything?" So Michael said, "You know, Larry, I know you're in a wheelchair. I was thinking maybe you have trouble getting things from the store. So I'm wondering, would you like me to pick anything up for you?" And Larry was taken aback. There's this pause. And Larry said, "No, got it covered." And hangs up the phone. So they have this kind of phone relationship of hate and love going back and forth. And one evening, Michael and his wife get a phone call, and it's Larry. And Larry says to them, "I have to get out of this life. I have all this neo-Nazi stuff, this KKK stuff. It's all around my apartment. Would you come over and help me get rid of it?" Now, Michael and his wife had been told by the police that Larry had guns in his apartment. Right? So what do you do at this point? Do they go over? I'm sure, against the better judgment of all of their friends and congregation and family members, they go over to Larry's apartment. And they go in and they pack up his Confederate flags and his Nazi swastika flags and all of the stuff. They pack it up into boxes and haul it out of his apartment and throw it away. And they started visiting Larry regularly. Larry's health continued to decline. They moved Larry into their own home. Michael's wife was a nurse. she quit her job and she began taking care of Larry full time.
Let me stop you just to ask, do you have any idea if there were consequences to Larry's leaving the KKK?
You'd have to buy the book.
Okay.
I don't know. I don't know that part of the story.
All right. We'll go on then.
Right. So the story was told to me when I went on an interview later on. I was listening to some NPR. It wasn't The Moth. It was some other storytelling story. And I hear this again. I was thinking, this is my story. This is the story I heard and the story that started something in me that I was still carrying around. So they bring Larry into their home. They take care of Larry. Michael's wife gives him medical care. And Larry starts reading and studying about Judaism. Eventually, Larry converts to Judaism. And he goes to the synagogue that he had threatened to blow up, and he gets called to the Torah as a Jew. Shortly after that, he died. When I heard this story, I wondered, right, will I ever have a Larry Trapp moment? That's what I thought of it as, a moment where I have the chance to reach out to somebody who... I'm not sure I ever envisioned myself reaching out to somebody who is dangerous like Larry. I mean, because honestly, if I had gotten the calls from Larry, I wouldn't have handled it like Michael Wasser did. I would have avoided it and blocked the number and done all those things that most people do. But still, I want... my Larry Trapp moment, would I ever have the chance to reach out to somebody unpleasant and make a connection and transform somebody's life, not necessarily converting them to Judaism, but transform somebody's life by reaching out? So I use that story in a High Holiday Rosh Hashanah sermon about a year ago, to encourage people to do just that, to reach out to somebody, a relative, a cousin, somebody they hadn't had contact with for a while, to be inspired by this Larry Trapp story. So that's the story that you heard from me at that clergy meeting, a gathering some time ago.
Right. And let me just break in for a moment to remind people that you're listening to Common Threads here on WGVU-FM. I'm Fred Stella, and my guest today is Rabbi David Krishev. Continue, David.
So the next piece of the story took place about 6 years ago on Easter. I was walking home with my daughter. Actually, I'm sorry, this wasn't 6 years. This is probably more like 10 years ago. But it was on Easter, which was also Passover. I was at the synagogue for services in the morning. I was walking home with my daughter, who was maybe 8 years old at the time. And at the end of the synagogue driveway, just by the street, we see an Easter egg. So, of course, my daughter is excited because she knows what's in Easter eggs, candy.
Yeah.
So she runs over, picks it up, opens it up, and there's a piece of paper inside. And I know immediately what it is and that I really don't want her to see it, but she's already unfolded and started reading it. And it's telling her why Jews are going to hell and that Jews should become Christian. What a message to leave in an Easter egg. As we're walking home, we walk past another synagogue, the Chabad house, and I cross the street, looked around their driveway, and sure enough, there's an Easter egg there too. The thing that really bothered me about this Easter egg is that it was unsigned. It was anonymous. Okay? Because I'm thinking, Larry Trapp moment, I would love to be able to talk to the person who wrote this disgusting message. And I couldn't. what I ended up doing is writing an op-ed for the Grand Rapids Press, and that's what led into the Ethics and Religion Talk column. While I was working with them to get this op-ed placed, I pitched my idea for the column because I wanted to have some sort of a forum where people who were of different religions and faiths could talk to each other, where people could ask questions, where they could listen to answers that were not from their own tradition. Right?
Dialogue. And were signed.
Right. So we've had unsigned questions from the teacher who wanted to know if it's okay to go skinny dipping. Understand why that was unsigned.
Okay.
But we like to have open and honest dialogue. So that's the next part of the story, this Easter egg, which is still, in fact, sitting on my desk at the synagogue as sort of a reminder of this whole episode. When was it? About a year and a half ago, I get this essay in the mail, and it's a 64-page essay. So two things are notable about this essay, which was the same thing as I found in the Easter egg, only much, much longer. I'll tell you more about it in a moment, but the two things that caught my eye first was that taped to the first page of the essay is a $50 bill. So clearly that's going to catch your eye.
I would think.
And the second thing is that both on the envelope and on the last page of the essay, the author signed his name, address. Right? Name is Tim Vance, and he's from Texas. And I'm thinking right away, this is interesting. Right? This is somebody who has the courage, at least, to stand behind what he writes. So I started reading it. And I knew it was the kind of essay that you find stuffed under the synagogue door a couple times a month or mailed, poorly Xeroxed. So I started reading the first few pages just to see what it was, and then I would be able to send him a letter back and respond.
You were told that if you read it, you could keep the $50, or was there any string attached to the $50? Was just here's $50.
Here's $50.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, no, I didn't have to read it. I could have just thrown it away and kept the money. I'll tell you what I did with the money, and I'll tell you what some of my rabbi colleagues suggested that I do in a moment. I only read the first few pages. That was basically enough, right? The first page said something like, "Jews are spiritually disgusting." Oh, okay, fine. If your goal is to get Jews to consider becoming Christian, it's probably not a good way to begin. But as I found out as time went on, Tim is nothing if not absolutely honest in the way he expresses himself based on what he believes. So he goes on, though, and this is really what secondarily caught my attention. He goes on to talk about Catholics, Muslims, Reformed Christians, Lutherans, lumps them all into the same spiritually disgusting category. Most of these letters don't do that, except maybe about Muslims and sometimes about Catholics. But to call Lutherans and Reformed Christians disgusting kind of piqued my interest a bit. And I didn't really want to read a 64-page essay and try to figure out, unravel what his theology was, but it was intriguing. So I was curious about whether any of my colleagues got this letter. It was I was I the only rabbi in North America blessed with $50 and an essay? Or is there some larger event happening at work? So I sent a note to my conservative rabbi email group, and they told me that a few people, volunteered that they had also gotten the envelope, or they knew rabbis in their city who'd gotten the same envelope. Most of them said that they put the money in the synagogue, or they pocketed the money, or I think one said he just returned the money and the essay. Several people said they contacted the FBI or the police and suggested that I do the same. And the thing is, nobody responded to Tim. Nobody wrote any sort of letter or response back to him other than just sending the whole thing back. Now, I looked at the essay again, and I didn't see anything in there that was any more threatening than
the Easter egg?
Than the Easter egg, right. Or what you'd find in a Christian Bible. Right? It may be insulting to Jews. Not maybe. It is insulting to Jews. But there was no threat in the essay. It didn't say, I'm going to come by your synagogue and burn it down. Or I'm going to hunt you down and I want to kill you. None of that. So I decided to respond. I responded both by publishing an open letter to Tim in the Ethics and Religion Talk column in the paper and online, and I mailed it to him as well. And so the first response I got, I mentioned his name, it's Tim Vance. The first response I got was by a Tim Vance in the comments online. I saw a comment from a Tim Vance that said, "So, how much would I have needed to give you to convince you to read the whole essay?" Because in my letter to him, I had said, I didn't read all of it, but thank you for the donation to the synagogue, whose mission it is to make Jews more actively Jewish. It's like a little needle at him. And it was kind of funny. He has a sense of humor. Later on, I found out that the Tim Vance with the sense of humor who commented was Tim Jr., and the author was Tim Sr.
I see.
But still, it was kind of fun.
Sure.
Shortly after that, I got a phone call from Tim Jr. asking me if I was willing to speak with his father. And he said his father was going to be, or could be, in Grand Rapids sometime in the next couple of weeks, wondering if I was willing to meet with his father. Right? So my Larry Trapp light inside my head is just flashing. Absolutely, I would love to speak with your father. So he called me, and he said that his wife was in hospice care. Both he and his wife grew up in Michigan. They have a cottage in Michigan. And after she dies, he and his family were going to come to Michigan for a little family time. And he said, I could drive through Grand Rapids if you're willing to see me.
That's interesting. That you were the only one who responded, and he has this connection to the area that might not have happened to the rabbi in Vermont or North Carolina.
Maybe not. A lot of things in this story were fortuitous. Yeah, if you like, you can see the hand of divine providence, fiddling around with this story just to help move things along in just the right direction.
Sure, sure. So go ahead. You made the appointment for him to meet with you. when he would be in Michigan.
Right. So about 2 weeks later, you know, his wife had passed away. He told me when he could be in Grand Rapids, and we met for breakfast. I think one of the first things I asked him was, why did I get this? How many did you send out? I know it was more than one, but why me? Answer was actually disappointing. He said he put together 50 envelopes. That's $2,500 he put together. So 50 envelopes, and gave them to his son and told his son, yeah, mail these to 50 rabbis. And he has no idea how his son chose which 50 rabbis. So I still don't, really? To this day, I don't know why I got one. But in a way, I'm glad I got it. So we spent maybe an hour. This is a few weeks before Rosh Hashanah, our major fall New Year holiday last year. We spent maybe an hour talking, and then I had to get back to writing my sermons and getting ready for, this is on Friday morning, getting ready for the Sabbath. I mean, it's a busy time of year.
And on that note, we're going to have to end this week's episode, but I am sure that you have everyone's attention. So we're going to invite you back next week, David.
I'll be here.
And we will come to the conclusion of this fascinating story. You've been listening to Common Threads on WGVU-FM. I'm Fred Stella. My guest today, Rabbi David Krishev from Ahavas Israel Congregation, the conservative synagogue here in Grand Rapids, Michigan. Please join us again next week here on WGVU.